Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
Last year, we removed 10,000 U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Another 23,000 will leave by the end of the summer. After that, reductions will continue at a steady pace with more and more of our troops coming home. And as our coalition agreed, by the end of 2014, the Afghans will be fully responsible for the security of their country.
My original instinct was to pull out. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
President Biden announces when U.S. troops will come home from Afghanistan. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Thursday, April 15th. Along with Joe, Willie, and me, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, member of the New York Times editorial board, Mara Gay, and Washington anchor for BBC World News America, Katty Kay, is with us this morning. A lot to get to this morning. We'll start though in Minnesota, where there was another night of protests following the police-involved shooting of Dante Wright. Hundreds of people, most of them peaceful, gathered outside of the Brooklyn Center Police Department for a fourth night in a row. Authorities say some people in the crowd were shooting fireworks and throwing objects at law enforcement, leading police to declare an unlawful assembly. Protesters were told to disperse several times, and by 10:30, many had left. Authorities say some of the remaining protesters were arrested, but the night was much calmer than what we saw earlier this week. Willie?
Meanwhile, the former police officer who fatally shot Dante Wright has been charged with second-degree manslaughter. Authorities say Kim Potter, a 26-year veteran of the Brooklyn Center Police Department, was taken into custody around 11:30 a.m. yesterday. Sheriff's records show she posted $100,000 bail and was released from custody shortly after 5:30 p.m. The second-degree manslaughter charge carries a maximum penalty of 10 years behind bars if she is convicted, Mika.
Let's bring in civil rights attorney and former Brooklyn, New York prosecutor, Charles Coleman. This one, Charles, I'd love for you to just give me your gut on the charges against Kim Potter and also the events that led up to the shooting of Dante Wright. Should they be looked at as closely as the actual shooting?
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me. I think that when you start looking at the charges, particularly with respect to the manslaughter charge that Potter has been currently charged with, what you have to basically surmise is that the prosecution here is already playing it safe. What they are doing is they are eliminating the element of intent by making the top count basically a charge that requires negligence, not a charge that requires intent. So basically the statute as it reads suggests that in order for her to be convicted, they have to establish that she was negligent in her duty, which basically will come down to a question of reasonableness of care or reasonableness as compared to whatever the standard of the law is. And so the question, if the indictment stays what it is, if the charges stay what they are, the question will remain, was it reasonable for a 26-year veteran on the police force to take their taser for their service weapon? And I think that that is, for the prosecution, already playing it very, very safe in this regard.
You know, Charles, it's so interesting you said that, because when we first get the news, and of course we didn't say any of this on the air, but you just assume, okay, somebody, there was a scuffle, somebody mistook their weapons. My original thought was, oh my gosh, this is terrible lack of training. This is somebody new on the police force. But the fact that this was a veteran, someone who had been around 26 years, even if it was a tragic accident, there is certainly, with a 26-year veteran, a standard of care that you would expect far differently than a rookie cop in that same position.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, I think you're absolutely spot on in terms of that assessment. But I would also say that, quite frankly, we are having the wrong conversation about whether she should have drawn her service weapon or whether she should have drawn the taser. At the end of the day, the question remains for me, stepping back from this situation a bit more, is why was there a need to use any sort of weapon or escalate the level of force being used for what amounted to a traffic stop for warrants? This was a misdemeanor warrant that Mr. Wright had. He should be here today. And quite frankly, I'm not necessarily convinced that the situation warranted that course of action. Now, reasonable minds may disagree on that point. However, I think it's deeply problematic when you start looking systemically at what has happened in the state of Minnesota regarding police force and civilians and the use of force there. So while I do appreciate the fact, and I also agree with you, that 26 years on the force should have invoked a greater sense of awareness in that situation, I'm yet to be convinced that that was even needed in terms of apprehending Mr. Wright for this misdemeanor warrant.
Well, and Mika talked about the chain of events a minute ago. Those chain of events that we look at, you question why three police officers even approached a vehicle for an expired tag. That fatal shooting of Dante Wright, of course, began with a traffic stop for a minor infraction. Wright was pulled over Sunday while driving an SUV. According to then-Chief Tim Gannon of the Brooklyn Center Police Department, it was a traffic violation related to an expired registration tab.
From what I've understood from the public safety briefing, there was an expired registration on the vehicle. That means the tabs were expired.
Now, according to the Star Tribune, Minnesota law forbids motorists from driving without current license tabs. But the paper also notes the deadly coronavirus pandemic is not slowed policing of these low-level offenses in recent months. Minnesota law does not allow a grace period when the license tabs are expired. The brightly colored stickers are no longer valid 10 days after the month listed on the registration plate. Gannon never said, though, when the tabs were lapsed on Wright's car. Why am I bringing this up? I mean, because while the policing of such offenses is not slowed, it does appear the process for getting those tab renewals have slowed down. A Minnesota Department of Vehicle Services spokeswoman told the Star Tribune last summer, the agency is behind on processing mailed-in tab and license plate renewals for thousands of Minnesotans.
Like across the country, because of the pandemic.
Because
probably.
Of the pandemic. At the time, she said many delayed requests were due in part because staff was telecommuting and did not have access to the mailed-in documents. Mara, I want to, there's a lot more we could talk about there. The thing that I've just not been able to come to terms with, and I say it here all the time, you know, Chauvin, he had 9.5 minutes. He knew what he was doing. He saw a man slowly die in front of him. We often see scuffles. We see police officers making terrible mistakes. People getting hurt or dying because of it. And that will be tried in court. And I will just say now, I suspect that a jury would probably have problems even charging this officer with negligent homicide. But let's step back. Why? Well, hold on. Excuse me one second. Here's a question. I'm sorry it's taking me so long to get to it. Why did three officers in the middle of the Derek Chauvin trial, 10 miles away from where that trial was being held, in an area that had a history of problems with race relations regarding policing, why did three officers feel the need to go up to a car with an expired tab? I mean, you talk about a lack of situational awareness. It's remarkable to me that they said, oh, this is what we're going to do this afternoon. We're going to pull somebody off over with an expired tab when we know that a lot of those tabs are expired because of COVID.
You know, the answer to your question, Joe, is unfortunately across America, police officers in those situations are often doing the job that the public has hired them to do. And I don't say that to be tongue in cheek. I mean that with all sincerity. I mean, you have a couple of things going on here. In some cases, you have officers who are bad actors, who need to be brought to justice. And then in other cases, I think this is the majority of cases across America, and certainly here in New York that I've covered in my career as a journalist, you have a situation where police officers are essentially set up along with the people that they come into interaction with, in many cases, to have these bad interactions that too often end in the loss of life of Black Americans who should still be with us. And so we really have to ask ourselves, what kinds of jobs do we want police officers doing? For example, do we want police officers being entrusted with policing, I don't know, homeless people for sitting on benches? Do we want them entrusted with pulling out guns instead of tasers at routine traffic stops? I mean, if this had happened in Europe, first of all, it wouldn't have. But the question we should be asking is, why are guns so readily available in the United States? Why are police departments so heavily militarized? It's not just the training, right? It's the culture of the way that we use police departments and the history of how we have used police departments in this country, which is heavily militarized and too often to police the bodies of those who are Black, Brown, and part of labor movement. And so I think that really needs to be part of the conversation here. And I don't know this, what was in Officer Potter's heart, but I do have a lot of empathy for the officers who are put in these situations as well, because ultimately, sometimes they are set up to fail. And that is no excuse. There should be personal accountability. But why are we putting all of this on individual officers only? There needs to be a larger conversation, I believe, about reform that doesn't just focus on officer behavior, but also focuses on the entire process by which we have empowered people in some cases with very little training and in other cases with very little accountability to make life and death decisions before the judge and jury have weighed in.
Yeah, and Willie, in this case, again, you have to ask why the police chief, why the department itself was having, you know, a situation where three police officers were approaching somebody on an expired sticker on a car, again, in the middle of the Chauvin trial. And this is the second time over the last week and a half, we've seen two Black men approached. One, weapons of course, drawn. In Virginia, the lieutenant in Virginia, who was pulled over for no reason at all. But they said, oh, you didn't have a tag.
Yeah, he did.
I'm curious how they didn't see the tag in his window.
Yeah.
And he did. Yes. And he did. And so we saw that tragedy, that humiliation of a Black man play out. And it was just absolutely sickening. And it sickened most everybody that saw it. It certainly should have everybody that saw it. But then in this case, here we have a sticker. You know, we absorbed that. We watched that. 2 or 3 days later, a young man is killed because of an expired sticker on the back of his license plate.
Yeah, no one ever obviously should lose their life over it. Expired tab in the back of the window. We also heard from the chief of police that he had something, Dante Wright had something hanging from his rearview mirror. He had an air freshener hanging. They pointed to that as evidence of a reason that he had violated, which apparently is a law in Minnesota. You can't have an obstruction from your mirror. But my God, we're talking about air fresheners and expired tabs, and a father and a son is dead because of that. Come on now, that doesn't add up. And we know for people of color in this country, we saw it in both cases, Lieutenant Nazario and Dante Wright, they knew how high the stakes were. You know, Lieutenant Nazario put up his hands and said, I'm afraid right now. And the officer said, you should be. Dante Wright called his mother when he was getting pulled over. Think about that. Why would a person call their mother? because he knew how high the stakes were. And tragically, he was right over an expired tab. As you say, this is all tied into the Derek Chauvin trial. We had the second day of witness testimony for the defense in the Chauvin murder trial. It was focused on the cause of George Floyd's death. Former Maryland chief medical examiner Dr. David Fowler argued Floyd's death should be ruled undetermined rather than homicide, because he says there were several conflicting factors there.
Yes, the placement of the knee is towards the back and the back right side of Mr. Floyd's neck, and the airway is around the front. It is nowhere close to his airway.
We were talking about having an open airway. How does that affect your ability to speak?
The ability to speak or make any other sound, groaning, and Mr. Floyd did groan. So any of the sounds that Mr. Floyd is making requires you to be able to take air in over the vocal cords and out over the vocal cords.
The defense also focused on where Derek Chauvin held George Floyd, the witness testifying that they were directly next to the car's exhaust and that carbon monoxide may have contributed to the death. Here's part of that testimony, followed by some of the prosecution's cross-examination.
Did you pay attention to where Mr. Floyd's head was positioned relevant to the squad car?
Yes, I did.
Which way was his face, nose, mouth facing?
His face was facing towards the vehicle, towards the rear of the vehicle, and directly towards the area where you would expect the tailpipe or tailpipes of a vehicle to be.
Now, just going right to the punchline of carbon monoxide that you talked about at some length, you haven't seen any data or test results that showed Mr. Floyd had a single injury from carbon monoxide. Is that true?
That is correct, because it was never sent to the laboratory for that test.
I asked you whether it was true, sir. Yes or no?
It is true.
Okay. Now, did you see any air monitoring data that actually would give you any information as to what amount of carbon monoxide, if any, would have been in Mr. Floyd's breathing zone?
No, because it was not tested.
It was a yes or no question. You haven't seen any, have you?
I have not seen any data.
Earlier in the day, the defense requested the judge acquit Derek Chauvin, arguing the prosecution failed to prove its case. The judge denied that request. Charles, so let's talk about what we're seeing here from the defense over these 2 days as they lay out their case. Obviously, it was a very compelling 2 weeks for the prosecution. They had their own medical experts who said that, in fact, George Floyd did die because of the knee on his neck from former Officer Chauvin. What are we hearing now from the defense, and how compelling do you think it might be to the jury?
Sure. What we saw when the prosecution presented their case in chief was essentially three different phases. The prosecution began by setting the tone for the trial in a very emotional way that was going to grab the jury in and set the tone for the color, the feel, and the emotions of what this was all about. And then we saw the prosecution begin to transition to what I believe is the most important part of the trial, and that is focusing on the technical aspects with respect to their experts and the medical professionals who were responsible for determining George Floyd's cause of death, which is a central element that the prosecution must prove in order to establish a conviction. And then we saw the prosecution sort of transition to a hybrid third phase where they sort of blended both the emotional with respect to George Floyd's brother and also still emphasizing some of the technical aspects. What we have seen from the defense is that on their first day of their case in chief, they began with essentially a cycle of witnesses that presented an opening or an introduction to each of their defenses. Their central defenses are threefold. Number one, that it was the crowd that may have distracted Derek Chauvin and fellow officers during that day. Number two, that there were additional causes of death. And number three, that Derek Chauvin's use of force was not actually unreasonable. And so because of that, now we are seeing more and more technical attacks. That's what we saw all day yesterday. And it's important that viewers understand this. The standard of what needs to be proved, the burden of proof, is beyond a reasonable doubt. And so what the prosecution is concerned with, as they are supposed to be, is that the defense, in terms of offering outside expert testimony is that they are going to create reasonable doubt. It's important that viewers understand it's not the quantity of evidence, and the judge is going to instruct the jury as much in as much as that it's not the quantity of evidence that is presented. It is the quality. They can choose to take in Dr. Fowler's testimony if they so choose and weigh it evenly against all of the testimony from the medical experts that the prosecution put forward. So what the defense is attempting to do is offer their own expert so that they can say, on summation, you've heard from experts from the prosecution. You've heard from experts from the defense. It's up to you to make the decision, mm-hmm. because what they want to do is create reasonable doubt.
So Charles, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I've had a growing sense of anxiety, and mm-hmm. we ought to read from Eugene Robinson's op-ed in a minute, but I've had a growing sense of anxiety over the past several weeks watching coverage of this trial, reading opinion pieces about it, listening to legal experts on news shows talking about it, and everybody's saying everything but this is a slam dunk. He's going to be convicted. The defense doesn't have the case. And it's caused a concern, because I don't think many people have the understanding that aren't attorneys of what you just said, that regardless of the evidence, a prosecution's case is precarious because it's beyond a reasonable doubt, and they can just find one juror and get a hung jury. And we think back to whether, you know, whatever the cases are that have shocked us in the past. I think Americans need to hear exactly what you're saying right now, is the burden's extraordinarily high. And while I saw the video and millions of Americans saw the video, and I think it's murder, and millions of Americans think so, I'm not one of 12 in the jury, and I'm just, again, I'm very fearful that people don't understand what you just said. They have to, whether it's causation, whether it's something else, whether it's drugs, they just have to find one juror and put reasonable doubt in one juror's mind, and you have a hung jury.
You know, Joe, you're exactly right. And I think that's the thing that gives me pause as an attorney and as a Black man, quite frankly, because I know that we cannot take these things for granted. We've seen video of heinous, ridiculous, horrific offenses that to the common eye would absolutely seem like no-brainers. We can go back to Rodney King. We can look at Walter Scott. We can look at Terrence Crutcher. We can look at over and over and over again different videos from different incidents, police on camera, unarmed civilians, and we can see from the common eye that this seems to be a no-brainer, and yet and still it does not result in a conviction. And I think your point about one juror, just one juror being the difference between a conviction and a hung jury is an important one. It only takes one juror to have reasonable doubt to end up with a hung jury. And I think that's what the defense is aiming for with the presentation of these experts.
Charles Coleman, thank you very, very much for your insight this morning. And we're going to continue this conversation next hour, reading from Gene Robinson's piece in The Washington Post. After 20 years of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan, President Joe Biden announced yesterday that it's, quote, time for American troops to come home. As Politico notes, the military spent more than a decade urging three different American presidents to stay in Afghanistan, with President Joe Biden's decision this week to withdraw all U.S. forces by September 11th. They finally lost the battle. Biden made the announcement from the Treaty Room, the same location where President George W. Bush announced a month after 9/11 that strikes against al-Qaeda had begun.
We went to Afghanistan because of a horrific attack that happened 20 years ago. That cannot explain why we should remain there in 2021. Rather than return to war with the Taliban, we have to focus on the challenges that are in front of us. When I came to office, I inherited a diplomatic agreement duly negotiated between the government of the United States and the Taliban that all U.S. forces would be out of Afghanistan by May 1, 2021, just 3 months after my inauguration. That's what we inherited, that commitment. It's perhaps not what I would have negotiated myself, but it was an agreement made by the United States government. And that means something. So in keeping with that agreement and with our national interest, the United States will begin our final withdrawal, begin it on May 1 of this year. We'll not conduct a hasty rush to the exit. We'll do it responsibly, deliberately, and safely.
After making the announcement, the president visited Arlington National Cemetery, where more than 2,300 casualties of Operation Enduring Freedom are buried. Joe, symbolically showing why he feels this must be done.
Right. Well, Jonathan Lemire, Joe Biden was a skeptic of our participation in Afghanistan before he was sworn in as vice president, famously having a confrontation in Afghanistan with then President Karzai, pushing away from the table, throwing down his napkin, and leaving because of corruption in that government. He then was opposed to Barack Obama increasing the number of troops in Afghanistan. So a lot of people not surprised by this decision.
Yeah, Joe, this was a long time coming, as you just laid out. Now President Biden has been a long time skeptic of Americans' presence there, long-running presence in Afghanistan. He was overruled repeatedly while vice president, but his position didn't change. He believed that, as he laid out yesterday, that America's mission in that country was to eliminate a safe haven for terrorists. That was, of course, the country where the September 11th attacks were launched from. And as he said yesterday, that had been accomplished. He also, and this is interesting, for a president who has been so quick to overturn and overrule so much of what he inherited from his predecessor, tossing out so much of President Trump's policy decisions, he said yesterday that that treaty that the Trump administration negotiated with the Afghanistans was legal. It was done correctly, and America should oblige by it, should honor it. Push back the timeline slightly, of course, and now there'll be the symbolic exit on the 20th anniversary of those terror attacks. But he felt like Americans needed to keep their word here. Now, of course, there has been some criticism from the usual suspects among Republicans, a few moderate Democrats in the Senate as well, and certainly some in the military establishment who feel that America's presence should still be there. And no question, there are real concerns as to what will fill that void. Will the Taliban roll back human rights gains, particularly for women in that country? But Biden laid out the sacrifice that American soldiers have really borne the brunt of for the last 20 years, NATO troops leaving as well. And he underscored that with the visit to the cemetery and speaking personally about his own son, Beau Biden, a veteran, and his service. So this, of course, will be a wait-and-see game. There'll be a lot of world leaders nervously watching what happens in Afghanistan. But this was something that was a long time coming for this president.
A long time coming for this president. Obviously, Donald Trump wanted to remove troops from the beginning of his administration and pushed back against generals in the Pentagon who pushed back against him. Willie, obviously, there is great risk to this move as well. We saw what happened when Americans cheered, including myself, this country's exit from Iraq. But that created a void. And into that void, ISIS moved. And then we had to send troops back over to clean that up. And there is no question that the Taliban will act as the Taliban always acts, towards civilians, towards women, towards young girls, towards people who aren't Islamic extremists. They will act abhorrently. New York Times reporting a few weeks ago that ISIS also gaining a foothold in Afghanistan as well. This certainly is something that the president and those in his cabinet understood and a risk they were willing to take. But there is no guarantee that we won't be back or some force won't be back in the future for the same reason we had to go back in to Iraq after we left.
And that's exactly the point a lot of military leaders, former military leaders like General David Petraeus made yesterday. He was very vocal with his criticism of Joe Biden. Of course, General Petraeus commanded forces in Afghanistan for a long time and said, the endless war doesn't end just because we leave. To your point, we may have to go back and clean up what we leave behind. And Caddy Kay, obviously, nearly 2,500 Americans have lost their lives over those 20 years. About 500 of our allies from the UK as well have lost their lives. This is not a celebratory moment. Just talking to veterans yesterday, people who served there, they're thinking about their friends who they lost there. They're thinking about the long-term damage to their own lives. And they worry, frankly, about what Joe was just talking about. Leaving, yes, they want to go home, but they worry that they may have to go back.
Yeah, I mean, the irony of U.S. forces in Afghanistan at the moment compared to Iraq is that actually the U.S. forces are very welcome by the Afghan people. They realize that they depend on them to preserve some kind of quality of life. We had an interview on the BBC yesterday with a Taliban leader in Afghanistan, and he was absolutely blunt about the fact that the Taliban today is what the Taliban was decades ago. He doesn't see that movement has changed. He said that they are just as rigorous. What they want is an Islamic State, and that they can continue to carry on campaigning for some kind of, you know, jihad in that area, which doesn't bode well, as you're suggesting, for particularly for Afghan women. But, and I had a conversation with Congressman Adam Kinzinger yesterday, who, of course, served in Iraq. And he made exactly the point that Joe made, that the real concern is that this is not in U.S. national security interest. There are 2,500 U.S. forces at the moment in Iraq. The last U.S. troop to have been killed in Iraq, in Afghanistan, was over a year ago. And those forces are protecting America's own national security interests. And if they pull out now, he said, his thought is that in a year, U.S. forces will be back in the region again, just because of the rise, not just of the Taliban, but of the Islamic State as well. And you can't monitor that. You can't do that with just a clandestine CIA force and drones sent from the Persian Gulf. It's just not possible.
And what you're hearing now, Mika, is, and this is something, again, this administration, the last administration considered this, you have soldiers, Marines that have served there, that this morning in the Washington Post and other papers, you hear their quotes about the guarantees that they made to the Afghan people, the guarantees that they made to women, the guarantees they made to young girls. Go to school. We will be here to protect you from the Taliban. To protect you from recriminations. It's the same thing, obviously, the same debate that we had when Donald Trump removed all of our troops that were working alongside the Kurds to push back against Assad, to push back against Iran, to push back against Putin, to push back against Turkey. And in that void, when they took out those 3,000 troops, of course, real concerns grew about what would happen in that region.
Yeah, I think on this very show, though, the debate has been on both sides of this issue. I mean, if the president announced we'd be staying for five more years, there would be many people on this set saying, how long are we going to be there?
Right.
How long do our men and women have to serve in this endless war?
I think really quickly, Mika, just to underline your point, I think that's the overwhelming majority view of most Americans. I think will likely support this president's view because they'll say 20 years is enough.
Absolutely.
Of course, we've been in Germany since 1945.
Yeah, but
we've been in Korea and we've had troops in the DMZ for 70 years.
So let's commit to forever. Like there's that the debate just can go either way, completely making sense on both sides. I want to bring in a different point of view. Joining us now, Democratic member of the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. And laying into that, I'll read from your tweet. Every time I went to Afghanistan, I met with a new general who told me the last general did it wrong and that this time was different. Is it time for perhaps a different take on the issue? And what do you think of the president's announcement?
Well, I think the president did the right thing. I think a decision to stay for another year would have effectively been a decision to stay forever. At some point, you have to accept the facts on the ground. This is America's longest war in our 240-year history. It is not a cold conflict. It is different than our troop presence in Germany or in South Korea because there is an active fight happening inside Afghanistan. And what you've seen over especially the last 5 years is the Taliban continue to advance because our presence in that country ends up being recruitment fodder for the Taliban and other extremist groups, and it becomes a crutch for the Afghan government. They don't really need to make the hard choices to be able to defend themselves or to be able to root out corruption so long as the American presence is there. So I think the decision that President Biden was making was not really a decision to stay another year, another 2 years. It was a decision as to whether we were going to permanently have 2,500, 5,000 troops in Afghanistan. And of course, this is a choice. You know, this is a week in which the Chinese are saber rattling around Taiwan. The Russians are amassing troops on the Ukrainian border. You know, we don't have limitless resources. And as you've mentioned on the show already this morning, Al-Qaeda has been degraded to the point where they have maybe 200 fighters in the entire country. They don't have the ability to directly plan attacks against the United States. It's time for our troops to come home, and it's time for the military to be able to reorient against threats that are much more serious to the United States and to the international rule of law.
So Senator, is there a time when the United States should have, as General Petraeus was saying yesterday, a small, narrowly focused, sustainable presence in countries like Afghanistan or when we were in Syria to assist the Kurds in pushing back against ISIS, pushing back against Putin, pushing back against Iran, pushing back against Assad?
My worry is that when we have these small forces and these relatively small military commitments, as we did, for instance, in Syria over the last 4 years, what we end up doing often is just extending the conflict. When, you know, we give just enough support for one side to keep the fight going, but not enough to be decisive, it just ends up in conflicts being elongated and there really not being the impetus for real settlement talks. And I think that's been part of what has happened in Afghanistan, that our presence there, again, has allowed for the Afghan government to keep up the fight rather than to necessarily sit down and engage in the kind of difficult conversations internally that would provide them the legitimacy to govern that country. So I get a little bit nervous when I hear about these sort of discussions regarding small U.S. troop deployments overseas. There's not a lot of evidence that they end up being decisive. There's more evidence that they just end up lengthening these conflicts.
Well, First of all, with all due respect, I don't think that 2,500 to 4,000 troops lengthened Assad's civil war in Syria. But doing that also, as we saw in Iraq, does that not at times prevent a bad situation from becoming worse?
Well, we also have other capabilities today to be able to track the true terrorist threats against the United States. There are ways in which we can both monitor and then with surgical precision go after the individuals who are, in fact, trying to plot against the United States. But, Joe, I guess I would push back in a place like Syria. I mean, I think what we did there was essentially give just enough support to these rebels who were fighting Assad to keep up the fight, but never enough support to them to actually beat Assad. Assad was always going to win that conflict. It was just a matter of when, not if, unless the United States was prepared to put, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 troops there. So, again, that's why I worry. And I know other people differ in that take, but I do think we have the ability with ISR, with surveillance, and with more surgical counterterrorism tools to be able to protect our interests in places like Afghanistan into the future.
Senator Chris Murphy, thank you very much for coming on the show early this morning. And we'll have more on the Afghanistan troops' decision when President Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, joins our conversation. Plus, the very latest on Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine, what a panel of experts is saying about the next steps for use of the single-dose shots. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Focusing. 3-2. Rodon. To third. Moncada. Carlos Rodon has thrown a no-hitter.
That is White Sox starter Carlos Rodon tossing the first no-hitter of his career in last night's 8-0 win over the Cleveland Indians. The 28-year-old lefty threw 114 pitches in that complete game no-hitter. Came two outs away from a perfect game, losing his bid right here on a hit-by-pitch in the ninth inning. That was an 0-2 pitch that just nicked the inside foot of the batter and losing the perfect game there. That's brutal. He settles, though, for the second no-hitter of the Major League season so far, 5 days after San Diego's Joe Musgrove tossed the first no-hitter in Padres history. Rodon in disbelief after his performance last night.
What's up, man?
Carlos! Dude, congratulations!
What just happened?
Where's your mind right now, Carlos?
On a toe ball? Nah, man, that was awesome. Full team effort. Holy crap. I can't believe it.
So the toe ball, Joe, was that pitch he threw that just barely nicked that foot of the Indians hitter and cost him the perfect game, but he did get the no-hitter. I'm sure you were distracted, though, by the Red Sox winning their ninth in a row, so that may be the first time you've seen that.
Yeah, no, I saw it, and he wasn't, Rodon wasn't pleased that the Indians batter made absolutely no effort to get out of the way of the ball. He just stood there. The foot didn't move, and he's going down to first base, and he says to him, dude, come on. I was pitching a perfect game. You couldn't have just lifted your foot a little bit, but he did not. No, you know, Willie, the Red Sox, it's difficult for me because, of course, I'm glad to see the Red Sox win, but Barnacle told me that the front office is banning not only myself, but Jack Scarborough and Joey Scarborough from going back to Fenway this year because the Red Sox record this year, when we're not watching a game live, it's 1,000. It's 1,000%. We go to the games, they lose. This was Verdugo made an, you know, he's trying to do a bit of a tendy thing here. This ended the first game yesterday. I'm 4-7 inning doubleheader games because it worked out well for the Red Sox yesterday.
That's an abomination, by the way, but that's another conversation.
As I tweeted a couple of days ago, why don't you just sing the Luxembourg national anthem at the beginning of every game and replace hot dogs with eclairs? But Devers is on fire. JD's on fire. Verdugo not only saved the first game, his bat helped win the second game. And Willie, I don't know. It's only April, so this means about as much as You know, my report card one weekend in eighth grade, I always ended up in the low 70s in all my classes. So, Willie, we've been surprised that you haven't jumped in. Jonathan Lemire and I have been continuing a tradition as old as time itself, Clubhouse. Mm. We always have the Red Sox pregame yes. on Clubhouse. We've been doing this since 1946. As you know, Willie, we came home a couple of hungry kids from the war and started a lot of things. We started Morning Joe, and Lemire and I started this Clubhouse deal. Barnacle Lupica, Lemire, and Joey Scarborough are doing it. But it's
actually fun.
But we're inviting everybody to get to come in because it's a good time, Lemire, and, you know, 48 million fans can't be wrong. You average, if you look at Armed Forces Radio, about 48 million, 49 million listen to Red Sox Clubhouse since 1940, pregame since 1948, every day.
I remember those shows back in the 50s when you'd have Ted Williams from Korea and you could barely make out what he was saying, but the crackling radio coming through on the Clubhouse, those were special as he'd give his analysis from far overseas. Jonathan Lemire, you've been kind so far not jumping on the Yankees' early start. Publicly, anyway, you've been brutal on text messages about Corey Kluber and some of the other pitchers. But as a Red Sox fan, I know you guys are conditioned to expect the worst. Has that changed now that you've become the dominant dynasty, the big money dynasty in baseball?
No, we're going to lose. We're going to lose, Jonathan. Don't fall for this trap. We're going to lose.
Let him speak.
Willie, the nine-game winning streak is soon to be followed by a 19-game losing streak.
There it is.
Joe and I are convinced. It's middle of April. This is a pleasant surprise considering how dreadful the Red Sox started under the watchful eyes of the Scarborough boys at Fenway Park, I will note. And Clubhouse, look, we've seen some highs and lows since 1946 with America's longest-running pregame show. Willie, we'd love to have you on board. You can discuss what might be ailing the New York Yankees right now, who I believe are residing in the cellar of the American League East. You can sort of mount a defense if you'd like.
Don't do that, Jonathan. Jonathan. It always jumps.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
I'm going to punish Jonathan.
Very cocky on tax day. It's April 15th. There's a long road ahead, Jonathan.
It is April 15th. Okay. Let me see here. Today, Jonathan? The game today.
1 o'clock. Jonathan, it's an afternoon game in Minnesota again.
Okay, 1 o'clock. That means the Clubhouse chat starts at 12:40. That All is right. the Red Sox.
And this is the time we were going to use to talk about Jonathan Lemire's new book. Okay, moving on because we're going to do the news now.
We'll get to Jonathan Lemire's book.
No, we'll get to that later. Okay, that's his punishment.
This is what the kids in the business call
consequence.
The deep tease.
No, this is a consequence.
Okay.
The advisory committee for the Centers for Disease Control decided yesterday to maintain the pause of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine while it continues to evaluate the situation. The panel decided it needed more time to assess the data and risks and will not vote on a recommendation until it meets again within the next 10 days. J&J's chief scientific officer said in part, quote, "We continue to believe in the positive benefit risk profile of our vaccine. We value the consideration of the advisory committee, and we will continue to collaborate with medical experts and global health authorities as we work toward continuing vaccinations to end the global pandemic."
So, Maura, what impact does this have on communities, not just across the United States, but across the world, regardless of the numbers, even if the FDA decides that the risk-benefit suggests that we should continue giving the J&J vaccines, what do these stories do to those who are already hesitant to take vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult moment, and it's a precarious moment for the world in terms of our fight against the coronavirus. The reality is that the CDC is actually acting within the normal protocols of what you do when a new vaccine comes out, in terms of being able to quickly maneuver and be nimble on their feet to test out the safety profile of a new vaccine. So the larger context here is that, you know, you can ask the question the opposite way, which is, if they weren't following that protocol, and Americans or people around the world, you know, came to find out that despite some safety concerns, that the CDC did not actually vet those and take a pause for a week or so, just to kind of knock the tires on that, what would that do to undermine trust in this vaccine? So there's no easy answer here, but I actually tend to believe that despite this is very frustrating, it's not something that we wanted to happen for sure. Johnson & Johnson is very confident that this vaccine will eventually be cleared by the CDC. But I actually think this was the right decision, and that hopefully they can move very swiftly and then be very clear with the public about the confidence that they have in this vaccine from the CDC's perspective. The difficult thing is that even though Johnson & Johnson only represents, that vaccine is about 5% of the national stockpile at this point, because it's one shot, it's meant to go specifically to populations that already may not have trust in the vaccine or access to the vaccine in the same levels, because it's much easier to convince somebody to take one shot than two. So all of this is to say that we're going to even have to just double down on our efforts to convince Americans and people around the world that taking these vaccines is worth it. But listen, people deserve access to as much information as the CDC has about the safety profile. So people deserve a right to know.
Yeah, no, every aspect of this is difficult. These new Western world warnings about the safety of certain coronavirus vaccines are jeopardizing vaccination campaigns in countries that cannot afford to be picky about shots available to them. As cases continue to rise and variants spread globally, the race to vaccinate faces multiple roadblocks, especially in Africa. The New York Times reports that in Malawi, people are asking doctors how to flush the AstraZeneca vaccine from their bodies. In South Africa, health officials have stopped giving the Johnson & Johnson shot 2 months after dropping the AstraZeneca vaccine. And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, 1.7 million AstraZeneca doses have gone unused. The decision in the U.S. to pause the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the EU's announcement that it would not purchase any more AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson vaccines is increasing the hesitancy. As the Times notes, if the perception takes hold that rich countries are dumping second-rate shots on poor nations, those suspicions could harden, slowing the worldwide rollout of desperately needed doses. And here's the big problem. The world needs to solve this problem, Katty Kay, not just the United States of America or the UK. I mean, one country can't stand alone in beating this virus. It's a global pandemic, and it does need to be approached from a global perspective.
Yeah, I mean, if we don't get everybody in the world vaccinated, then effectively we have to seal ourselves off from the rest of the world. And that just doesn't work, right? If we want to have any sense of travel or trade or movement or business travel, we have to make sure that other countries are vaccinated, not just on moral grounds, but also on economic grounds. There actually wasn't very much vaccine hesitancy, as I understood it from our correspondents in Africa, prior to the problems that we saw with AstraZeneca and now with Johnson & Johnson. But when you have news like yesterday where a whole country, Denmark, bans the AstraZeneca vaccine from its government rollout, that, of course, sends a message. People are hearing that in Tanzania, in Congo, in South Africa, and they're understandably thinking to themselves, hold on a second, that rich country, Denmark, has just decided it's not even going to distribute this vaccine ever. Wow, it must be really unsafe. why would I want to take it? They're going to send it to me. A rich white country is going to send it to Africa, and it's going to cause me problems. And vaccine hesitancy in Africa has spiked enormously since the beginning of the AstraZeneca problems. I mean, I think Mara's right. The only thing that authorities can do is be transparent. It would have been catastrophic if we had heard the news in the headlines that somebody had died because of a blood clot related to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the government had somehow covered it up. That really would have increased conspiracy theories around vaccines. So regrettable though it is that there is this pause, and it may be that it doesn't help. We still have the vaccine hesitancy anyway in these emerging economies. You've got to have transparency from the authorities. We've got to feel that we can trust our authorities on this.
Absolutely. Joining us now, Morning Joe Chief Medical Correspondent, Dr. Dave Campbell. Dr. Dave, what do you make of this pause? There are major health experts in the government and outside of the government that are supportive of it, but also clearly, you know, have the same concerns that this is going to lead to bigger problems. Is there a line of thinking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that this decision is important, that it is paused for much longer now?
Yeah, Mika, this is not a decision that was made in a vacuum, and I think that has been important in my reporting. It turns out the New England Journal just published two reports about the AstraZeneca vaccine having similar problems that we've been talking about already today. So now we know on the worldwide stage that two vaccines out of the plethora that have been or are under development have problems with blood clots. And that's the AstraZeneca. And now we see that's the J&J. So the reports that came out literally just this week in the New England Journal about AstraZeneca included Germany and Norway, where some of these similar problems that we're seeing with J&J are happening. And those two vaccinations are rather similar platforms. They're different, importantly different, than the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines. So if we go back to a year ago, when we remember that the governments of the world, and particularly the United States, were supporting lots of different companies and lots of different vaccine platforms, now we see it shaking out a little bit, and some are having some issues, maybe related, maybe not. That's the question that are trying to be answered now by the CDC and the FDA and scientists across the world. But we also know that Moderna and Pfizer have already come out saying that they are going to continue to up their production to try to meet these needs. It's a complicated problem across the world. The world's in between a rock and a hard place. But what happened this week with J&J should not be viewed as in a vacuum, because we saw something like this coming with the AstraZeneca vaccine. So we are going to stand by and wait for this advisory committee on immunization practices to look at more data,
right,
to have more time and to study this, because it is indeed important that as many people as possible across the world get vaccinations.
So Dr. Day, I'm just curious about the rate of incidences here. Obviously, I gave the example of me taking the anti-inflammatory Bextra, and there were quite a few incidences back in 2000 or around that time, and they took it off the market. This happens from time to time. I'm wondering if we're actually applying an even stricter standard to these vaccines when you look at the level of incidences compared to the number of people that are actually using the J&J product.
Joe, it goes back to this risk-benefit issue. And remember, when you get a vaccine, you're generally a healthy person being given something to prevent a disease. So the risk-benefit analysis, as in all medicine, is a little different if you're trying to prevent something in someone healthy versus treat somebody that already has a disease. So while there is some consistency to what you're saying, vaccines are held to a higher standard in general. And looking at the number of complications that may be associated, say, with the AstraZeneca, it was a handful in Germany and Norway. And now we see six, maybe seven people in the United States with the J&J vaccine platform, having had these really critical blood clots. So it's an important ethical question, but it's an important public health question as well, Joe.
All right. Dr. Dave Campbell, thank you, as always, for coming on this morning.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.